Well, greetings to students in Earth Science 2150. Radio Solar System is back on the air again with an introduction or an overview of Module 2 in the course. This is a relatively short presentation. Its primary purpose is to give you some information about scientific background concepts, things that you're going to need to understand and know a little bit about in order to succeed in this course. I'm not going to talk about stuff in detail. If you go to Module 2 on the Brightspace website, you'll find two presentations, one of which concerns basic science concepts and the other one of which concerns some basic Earth science concepts. So I would recommend that you consider having a look at these after you've had a look at this introductory presentation. That's the sound to indicate that it's time to change the slide. So you should now be on slide 2, which really summarizes some of the things we're going to talk about in this short presentation. First of all, we need to talk about numbers. We have to deal with things that are incredibly small and things that are incredibly large. We also have to deal with concepts of time, particularly the immensity of geological time, or what might be called perhaps cosmological time, which is even longer than geological time. We're going to need to know a little bit about the structure of matter. These are things that you would have learned about in high school, I hope. And we're also going to eventually need to know about things connected to minerals and rocks and key aspects of Earth science processes. We all know what minerals and rocks are, sort of generally, but they have rather specific meanings, and some of them are particularly important in planetary science. There are also concepts related to energy, which will be important to understand, and other things that fall into what we'd call basic physics, things like Newton's laws of motion, stuff like that. Okay? All of these things come into this course at various times. Today I'm just going to talk about a few of them in very general terms so you have an idea of what's involved, and then you can look at the more detailed presentations if you feel you have a need for more information. So let's move along to the next slide. Slide 3, well, we need to understand about numbers. You know, that's the first thing we need to understand about, because we're dealing with numbers that are impossibly large and in some cases impossibly small. Here's an example. This is the Andromeda Galaxy. It's usually the thing you'll see in any photograph that's supposed to be our own galaxy is actually Andromeda. But although it's the closest galaxy to us, it's really quite a long way away. It's 2.5 million light years away from us, roughly. And you don't yet know what a light year is, probably, but you'll find out in a few moments. What does it actually mean? And similarly, the universe itself is over 13 billion years old, which is another inconceivable number. It's inconceivably older than the Earth, which is 4.5 billion years old. Again, what does it actually mean? And how do we deal with numbers of this type? Because really, they're very hard to visualize and very hard to simplify. And the answer to this, of course, falls into the category of exponential notation. This is something you should have learned about before. If you haven't, you're going to need to know a bit about it. To the next slide now, slide 4. This is how we deal with such big numbers. Okay, if we're going to talk about atoms or we're going to talk about galaxies, we need some way of dealing with things. You know? And we can't use things like meters or kilograms or anything like that, or hours or years, because the ranges are just too enormous. So what we do is use exponential notation. So you need to know about this and how to do simple calculations with it. So there's an example here on this slide. 1.5 times 10 to the power of 8 divided by 5 times 10 to the power of 7. Now, if you can't figure out how to do that and get an answer from it, you definitely need to go and have a look at the materials and the examples in Module 2. You need to have a look and need to understand this a little bit better. I will say a couple of more things about it, but nothing in great detail. Next slide. There is, of course, a rule of thumb. You look at the exponents in the number. Every difference of 1 in an exponent means a factor of 10. If there's a negative exponent in a number, it means it's a very small number. And basically, you can just calculate these things quite easily. So if we wanted to figure out how far Andromeda really was in comparison to the distance to the Sun, we can take those two numbers. The distance to the Sun is about 1.5 times 10 to the 8 kilometers. And Earth to Andromeda is about 2.4 times 10 to the 22 kilometers. Okay? That's when we work that out. If we work that out by the, what we have to do there is divide the distance to Andromeda by the distance to the Sun, and we find out that Andromeda is about 1.6 times 10 to the 14 times more distant than the Sun from the Earth, which is inconceivably far away. Okay, so get used to dealing with these numbers because we will encounter them. Sometimes we get around it by using millions and billions and things like that, but generally we have to come back to exponential notation to really understand things. Next slide. This is slide 6. Well, distances are pretty large in the universe, no doubt about that. We measure distances generally in light years. Okay, so for example, we can look at galaxies across the universe and we find that they're all moving, and some of them are moving faster than others. And in fact, the speed with which a galaxy is moving correlates with its distance. And all this is connected in the end to the speed of light. The speed of light is 3 times 10 to the 8 meters per second, or 3 times 10 to the 5 kilometers per second. So this is a basic measure of distance, the time that it takes light, or the distance that light will travel in a year. So what kind of distance units would we use? What other distance units do we use in order to accommodate these things? Light years are not the only one, but they are the most frequent in use in stellar astronomy. Next slide is slide 7. Some other units that we use the astronomical unit, and that's defined as the distance between the Earth and the Sun. And that's about 1.5 times 10 to the 8 kilometers, which is about 150 million kilometers. So that's pretty useful inside the solar system. We could say, for example, that Venus is about 0.72 astronomical units from the Sun. We have to use light years once we go beyond the solar system. So at 3 times 10 to the 5 kilometers per second, it will cover about 9 times 10 to the 12 kilometers in a full year. And that's because the number of seconds in a year is approximately 3 times 10 to the 7. And that's a very long distance. Now, you might have also heard the term parsec. It's quite commonly used in science fiction movies and things like that. Sometimes it's used as if it's the same thing as a light year, but it's not. It's actually different to a light year, and we'll explain why it's different a little later on. Don't worry about it for now. It's an astronomical unit that's about 3.2 light years. So let's have another look at next slide, which concerns the measurement of time. So moving to slide 8, well, most of the time in this course, we're dealing with really long periods of time. So we're going to be talking about units of millions of years. 1 m.y is a million year. 1 million years ago is 1 ma. Ma stands for mega annum. Similarly, a billion years is called 1 gy. It's a giga year. Okay, or it's 1 billion years ago, 1 ga. So you'll see this notation in things, and it refers to very long periods of time measured in millions or billions of years. You might sometimes encounter billions of years and BA in some very old resources, but not many. So how old is the Earth? Well, luckily for us, it's an easy number to remember. 4,567 million years, or 4.567 GA. And that's also the time of the formation of the solar system, essentially. And how old is our species? Well, not sure exactly, but the human species certainly is no older than 2 million years and probably much less than that. So a tiny fraction of this time is represented by our existence on the planet. So these time units, of course, are used in Earth science quite routinely, and we apply the same things in planetary science as well. Next slide. Now slide 9. There is a full geological timescale that consists of geological periods and things like that. We don't really need to know all of the details of this. Some of this we will mention at time. It's a good idea to know some of the basic units, like the Hadean, the Archean, the Proterozoic, and the Phanerozoic, which are shown here. Okay? The solar system's been around for about one-third of the time that the universe has existed. The universe probably is about 13.8 billion years old, 13.8 GA. Now, on the Earth, we can find a few rocks that are around 4 GA old, 4 billion years old, and we find mineral grains that are as old as 4.4 billion years. How do we actually know that? Well, we'll find out later on as we go through the course, and you'll find out more about it if you look at Module 2 as well. You'll find out how geologists measure time, some of the methods that are used, and the uncertainties that exist in that as well, of course. So you need to understand a little bit about this. And finally, in this little introductory part here, let's talk about temperature scales. Next slide. Slide 10. Well, temperatures vary quite widely in the solar system. It's extremely hot on the surface of Venus. It's as hotter than any other planetary surface on average, and it's extremely cold when you go out to Neptune and Pluto. So, inside the Sun, temperatures are actually measured in millions of degrees centigrade. We generally don't use the centigrade scale in science, although we do use the same units. We commonly use what's called the Kelvin scale. That's named for Lord Kelvin, who's a famous early physicist. And the units are the same, but 0 degrees Kelvin in degrees centigrade is equivalent to a number called minus 273.15 degrees Celsius. Minus 273 is good enough for most purposes. And that's the number that's called absolute zero. And that's the coldest temperature possible in the universe. And we won't go into why that is, but that is a fact. It's one of the limits of the universe. So we tend to use this scale instead for a number of reasons. The first is that mathematics is much easier if you have a scale that only has positive numbers in it. Right? And also because it's an absolute measure of warmth too, because it can't be colder than minus 273. So remember that, and remember that the average temperature of the Earth, which is getting hotter bit by bit, is about 290 Kelvin, or somewhere around 17 degrees Celsius. Okay, so what else do we need to revisit in terms of basic science concepts? In the next slide, which is slide 11, there are the states of matter. I think you all know this, solids, liquids and gases. You're all familiar with this. These are the three states of matter that we encounter all of the time. An obvious example is water. Water can occur in all three of these forms, and in fact does occur in all three of these forms simultaneously in many parts of the world. There is, however, another state of matter that you might not have thought about. And that's summarized here in slide 12. The most dominant, the most abundant type of matter in the universe is actually plasma. Plasma is a high-temperature ionized gas that's emitting radiation, and that's what makes up the Sun and it makes up the stars. And I should mention at this point that there are things about matter in the universe that we really don't understand at all. In particular, there's something called dark matter, which we'll talk about briefly in Module 3. The galaxies in the universe seem to have more matter in them than we can account for by all the stars in it. So there's something that we're not able to detect that has mass as well, a type of matter that's very enigmatic. We call it dark matter. So that covers some basic things that come from high school science that you should know about. And if you've not heard about these things, you need to have a look at Module 2. Let's move a little further now and talk a little bit about some slightly more advanced science concepts that you will need some knowledge of. Well, first of all, slide 13 here, you're going to need to know something about basic chemistry. You're going to need to understand about atoms. You're going to need to understand about isotopes also, and also what ions and molecules are. Now, this is basic high school science. We're not going to talk about it in detail. You can go and have a look at Module 2 for some more information. I'll say a few words now so that you'll get an idea of what's involved. Next slide. So that takes us to slide 14, and I would hope that this is familiar to almost everyone who's looking at this presentation. This is the periodic table of the elements that shows the fundamental divisions into columns of elements that have similar chemical, and not necessarily physical properties, but similar chemical properties. And the periodic table is a fundamental part of science, and you should know something about it. You should know what's a gas in there, what's a metal, what's a semi-metal, and things of that nature. To be more specific, you also need to know the differences between elements and isotopes. Okay? In the periodic table, elements belong to different groups. They're called metals, non-metals, and semi-metals, and they differ in properties. What is an isotope? Well, an isotope is a variety of an element that shares most of the chemical properties, but will differ in its atomic structure. In other words, it's got slightly different makeup in terms of elementary particles that make up the atoms. Some isotopes are radioactive. That means that they will change into another chemical element if you give them enough time. Some of them do it quickly. Some of them do it very, very slowly over long periods of time. And that's how we measure time in Earth science and also in planetary science, is through radioactive isotopes. But there are other isotopes that are stable. They don't change over time at all. They just exist. And both of these kinds of isotopes are pretty important to us. We get natural clocks from radioactive isotopes that help us tell when, how old things are and when things happen. And stable isotopes give us fingerprints for the sources of materials. For example, if we want to know where the Earth's water comes from, we can compare it to the isotopic composition of water from comets, which is something we'll talk about later on too. So I'll just quickly detail those examples here in the next slide. How old is the Earth? Well, we figure that out by using the decay of two isotopes of uranium that decay to isotopes of lead. By using them and by figuring this out, the amount of lead versus the amount of uranium in particular minerals and particular materials, we can figure out that most of the meteorites in the solar system are about 4.5 billion years old or older, and that's probably the age of the solar system too. Where does the water come from? Well, an idea for many years was that it came from comets. Comets are mostly made of ice. We do have some information of the ratios of stable hydrogen isotopes in comets now, but they're rather different to those that we measure for the Earth's water in oceans and ice caps and things like that. So it sort of looks like this idea might not be correct. Well, maybe. There isn't a lot of information yet, so perhaps the jury's still out on it. Bottom line is, if you don't know what isotopes are, you should go and have a look at Module 2, because you're going to need to know about this. Next slide. Takes us to slide 17 now. We'll shift gears now a little bit from physics into chemistry into physics, rather. Gravity. Gravity is pretty fundamental across the universe. It makes, well, it doesn't really make the world go around, but it makes the world go around the sun, we might say. And a lot of things about gravity really aren't fully understood, even though we know well enough how it works. So we're going to talk about gravity quite a bit in Module 4 and its use in planetary science. And that's going to be easier if you can retain some basic Newtonian physics, things like Newton's laws of motion. I would certainly recommend that you have a look at those. There's a little bit of information on this in Module 2, and we'll talk about it more in Module 4. Something that needs to be mentioned at this point too, in slide 18 here, is the problem or the process of computer modeling. And science, in all aspects of science these days, makes a lot of use of computer models. And this is particularly true in planetary science because our ability to make direct observations is somewhat limited. So these computers are able to deal with hugely complex things like gravitational fields, like planetary motions given long periods of time, or fusion reactions in the sun, for example, you know, that generate energy in the sun. They're all extremely valuable, but it's always important to remember that there are limits to computer models. They are limited by the knowledge of the inputs to those models and the accuracy of those estimates. And some computer models will tell you that something is possible, but it doesn't necessarily tell you that it's the right answer. The computer models may give more than one answer. So bear this in mind as we go through the course. We'll run into quite a few examples here where perhaps the assumptions in computer models need to be thought about carefully before you accept their conclusions. The next slide now is slide 19. It's a picture of a comet. Well, there's a module of the course that's devoted to energy in the solar system and the sun. Okay? A lot of this concerns electromagnetic energy, which is probably the most important thing. But let's not forget the kinetic energy in the solar system too. Planets are moving around pretty fast. It comes from gravitational forces, but also the processes of initial formation too. There's thermal energy inside planets and inside bodies within the solar system. Once again, understanding some basic physics is important for dealing with these parts of the course, and that particularly applies to a knowledge of the electromagnetic spectrum, which we'll see in the next slide. So now to slide 20. Once again, I would hope that most of you are familiar with this, that you've come across it in previous science courses. These are the regions of what's called the electromagnetic spectrum, okay, which covers all sorts of things from radio waves, long-wave radio waves, through visible light, which is a very narrow interval within that spectrum, through to gamma rays and other things that are definitely not good radiation that we would like to be exposed to. Ultraviolet is in there too. There's basically two measures of electromagnetic energy, and they're called frequency and wavelength, and they're actually opposites. They're inversely correlated. One hertz is one cycle of a wave per second, okay? And that's how we define wavelength. And a frequency is the number of waves that occur within a second. Okay? So, wavelength is the length, the distance between the crests of waves. So once again, this is basic physics, and you should have some knowledge of this. Have a look at Module 2 if you're not familiar with it. Two things to remember, important things. When the wavelength gets shorter and the frequency gets higher, electromagnetic radiation carries more energy. That's why gamma rays and X-rays and ultraviolet are more dangerous to us than radio waves. And also that visible light, what we look at with our eyes, is just a tiny region in the middle of the electromagnetic spectrum. There's a lot of other information that's outside the ability of our eyes to detect it. But nowadays we use this quite a lot for examining other planetary bodies both within the solar system and outside the solar system. Next slide. More on energy. Well, the most obvious source of energy is the sun. This obtains its energy from nuclear fusion. The sun and almost all other stars in the universe, except for a few, create energy by turning hydrogen atoms into helium atoms. And we can analyze the energy output of the sun, and that tells us a lot about what's going on inside it. Similarly, we can analyze the energy output of stars across the universe, across the galaxy, and find out about processes within them too. And let's not forget internal energy in planets too. Planets have internal energy, which is left over from their formation processes. That's certainly true on the Earth. We have lots of evidence of volcanic eruptions on the Earth. There's almost always something erupting on the Earth at any given point. This is true also for Venus. Venus certainly has active volcanism. I think we're very convinced of that. It may not be true of all planetary bodies in the solar system, because this energy dissipates over time and smaller planets lose their energy more quickly. So let's not forget about that. Okay, that takes us to slide 22, the next one, in which we'll briefly have a look at a few Earth science concepts. Now, as you know, it's an Earth science course, even though it doesn't require any Earth science course as a prerequisite. But there are lots of themes between Earth science and planetary science, and the two things are very well connected. And William Anders, who was an Apollo astronaut, said it very well. He said that when we went to the moon, the most important thing is that we discovered the Earth. We saw the Earth as a single entity, and we discovered a lot about how the Earth works through the space program, through this knowledge and through our ability to observe the Earth with satellites and things like that. So having Earth science concepts in this course is important. They form reference points for a lot of the things that we're going to discuss, and you need to understand something about some of these ideas. So let's just run through a few quickly here. And if you're not familiar with this stuff, you've never done an Earth science course, then you definitely need to look at the second part of Module 2. Next slide. This just shows you the process of chemical bonding. This is slide 23. Ionic bonding, as we call it. Sodium chloride, or salt, being used as an example here. That's actually a natural mineral called halite. Okay? Minerals are the building blocks of pretty much everything that we deal with in planetary science. Okay? Minerals are naturally occurring inorganic compounds, so we need to understand some basics of chemistry. Now, the bad news about minerals is that there are thousands and thousands of them, especially on the Earth, which has great diversity in mineralogy. The good news is that there's only a few very common ones, and the mineralogical variety in other solar system bodies, from what we understand, is more limited than that we see on the Earth. But you're going to need to know a few things about a few of them, so go and have a look at Module 2, and learn a little bit about this, the different kinds of minerals and the common ones that are important throughout the solar system. Next slide. This is slide 24. It just says something about chemical elements in the solar system. Well, if you look at the universe, you might be surprised to find that the most abundant element is hydrogen, followed by helium. That actually makes up pretty much all the universe. Virtually all mass in the solar system is in the sun, which is largely hydrogen. So that's true in the solar system too. And when we look at gas giant and ice giant planets in the solar system, they are not identical to the composition of the sun, but they're quite similar to it in a lot of respects. Once again, hydrogen and helium are very important components of them. But if we look at terrestrial planets, like the one that we live on, they're quite varied. And if we look at the Earth's crust, the outer shell of the Earth, if you like, we'll find that mostly it's made of oxygen, which is followed by silicon, aluminum, iron, calcium, sodium, and potassium. Those are the principal elements that we find on the Earth. Any other terrestrial planets are probably broadly similar too. So terrestrial planets are obviously quite different in their composition to the Sun. So that's an important question that we'll need to think about as we go through this course. Next slide. This is slide 25. What's the relationship between minerals and rocks? You need to know about this. Minerals are the things that make up rocks. Rocks are what we see on the surface of the Earth, but they're made of combinations of minerals. And the same is true on other terrestrial planets as well. And some of those rocks are actually quite familiar. So just bear this in mind. Module 2 will tell you a little bit more about this, and we'll discuss more of it when we come to talk about the Earth as well. Next slide. Now to slide 26. This is an illustration of what's called the rock cycle, and this is what we see on the Earth. So we define different kinds of rocks, sedimentary rocks, igneous rocks, and metamorphic rocks, and you'll need to know what these are. And these are in Module 2 as well. And we have a cycle that links them all together. In other words, we can take igneous rocks and we erode them, and then we turn them into sedimentary rocks, and then we bury them back in the Earth and turn them into metamorphic rocks, and sometimes we melt them and turn them back into igneous rocks. So we have a very dynamic system that's moving things around on the Earth over very long periods of time. And that is also the case perhaps on other planets in the solar system, particularly on Mars, maybe so on Venus as well, but those processes are going to be different. Next slide. Slide 27, that's a map of the tectonic plates of the Earth. And that's really what gives us the Earth cycle. It's the motion of tectonic plates on the Earth's surface, or the Earth's outer region, that causes most geological processes. And so the crust of the Earth can in fact be divided into these plates that are in relative motion. And this is fundamental in Earth science. Plate tectonics is a really important concept in modern Earth science. And it's also very important in the context of this course too. So we will talk about it more when we go to the Earth in Module 7. You'll get a little bit of information in Module 2 to get you started. And just to give you some advance information, what's happening on the surface of the Earth is in turn linked to internal processes. It's linked to what's going on inside the Earth. In particular, it's linked to processes going on in what we call the mantle, which is a region of silicate rocks that's actually moving. It's actually convecting, moving around in response to heat from inside the Earth. Now, we're not going to talk about this in detail in Module 2. We'll talk about it more when we get to the Earth itself. But the most important thing to remember is that inside the terrestrial planets, things are different than they are on the surfaces of terrestrial planets. Terrestrial planets are divided into a number of concentric shells that have different compositions and different characteristics. So another important thing that we need to explain. Next slide. Now, we talked before briefly in the introduction about the Earth system concept. The Earth system concept takes all of the aspects of the Earth, including the living material of the Earth, and postulates that there are many interactions between them that help to maintain the Earth's surface environment and possibly also affect deep processes within the Earth too. So we thought talk of the lithosphere, the hydrosphere for all the water, the atmosphere for the gases that surround us, and the biosphere for the living component. Very important concept. Again, we'll talk about it more when we talk about the Earth, but also Module 2 will give you some basic information about this. So, almost to the last slide now, okay? This really summarizes the Earth system's concept, basically. We will say that Earth is not the only planet that has a hydrosphere. It's very likely that Mars has a hydrosphere too. It's just hidden inside and it's mostly frozen. And we're certainly not the only planet with an atmosphere, because several planets have atmospheres. But we might well be the only planet in the solar system that has what we might call an extant biosphere, in other words, a living biological component. But that doesn't mean that there isn't an extinct Martian biosphere, because conditions were different on Mars in the past. And a discovery like that, as I'm sure you understand, would have huge implications for our concept of where we are and how important we are within the universe. So we just have a couple of slides left in this short overview. Slide 30. Well, what's this? What do you think this is and how does it happen? I won't tell you right now. In the next class, when we come to Module 3, we'll talk about this and a range of other things that represent observations of the sky that humans have been making for probably tens or hundreds of thousands of years. And finally, just to emphasize once again, don't neglect this background knowledge, the stuff that's talked about in Module 2 of this course. Even if you've done a science course, it's worthwhile to have a look at this. And that's because the principles of science apply throughout the universe. That's why they're called universal. And similarly, many principles of Earth science apply very well to other planets as well, especially to terrestrial planets. For example, the most abundant rock type on terrestrial planets, as far as we can tell, is also the most abundant rock type on Earth. It's a volcanic rock called basalt. Okay? So earth science knowledge is important for this course. If you don't have that knowledge or you've never encountered it before, please have a look at Module 2. Later modules are going to give you more information on aspects of this, but you will need this starting point. You'll need this reference point of basic knowledge to continue. So that's all we have as an overview for Module 2. It's one module that sometimes people neglect to look at. I certainly don't recommend that course of action. I would have a look at it in the first week of this course to prepare yourself for what's going to come later on. So that's good for now. Module 3 will talk about observations of the sky and also some basic elements of the solar system that we need to know about. Thank you very much. We're off the air for a little while, but we'll be back very soon throughout this semester.